Yorkie since she had no comms. "Are you whole?" Ryan asked.
"Affirmative,"
Adara said. "We're pinned down in a bar across the street called the Albatross, a Blackstone front. Pretty sure Chen thinks we're armed because he's not rushing us."
"Copy," Ryan said. "Sit tight a minute. Yuki is armed, and I have a little chief special."
"Yuki?" Chavez said.
"I'll explain later," Ryan said. He turned to Yuki. "You have backup anywhere nearby?"
"My partner is busy with the G-20.
She shook her head.
"I stopped off here to interview a contact who knows Kim Su. I did not expect her to be here."
"Great," Midas said.
"I did not expect you to be here," Yuki said.
Rain dripped from her nose.
"Any of you? In any case, gunfire is extremely rare in Japan. Ammunition is accountable here, not just firearms. Police officers are at this moment getting ready to converge on your friends. It would be best for me if we took care of Chen before the authorities arrive. Less explaining, if you know what I mean."
Jack nodded, dabbed at the wound on his side. It would need a few stitches, but his rib bone had taken the brunt of the attack, doing what ribs were designed to do and protecting his heart and lungs. It would hurt like a son of a bitch when the adrenaline wore off. Yuki was drenched and beginning to shiver. He considered giving her his jacket, but thought it would offend her, considering the circumstances.
"You've got 8 rounds," he said, wiping the rain off his face.
"I've got 5. That leaves..."
Adara's voice cut him off again.
"Jack," she said, "Chen and the girl are coming back your way."
Sirens began to wail around Shinjuku train station. Ryan peeked around the vending machine to see Chen and Kim Su sprinting toward him. Chen had his head down against the pouring rain, but the Korean woman saw Ryan and brought up a pistol, firing as she ran. Rounds thwacked against the vending machine, just inches from Ryan's face. He shot twice, aiming center mass at Chen, who was also armed and in the lead. He hoped like hell the rounds stopped, but didn't kill the bastard. They really, really needed to talk to him.
Yuki dropped to her knees as Ryan fired and leaned around the machine, shooting steadily, purposefully, dumping 7 rounds and staying aimed in while she reloaded a fresh magazine from her pocket. Both Chen and Kim Su fell, their pistols skittering across the wet pavement. More gunfire erupted from the other end of the alley.
"Talk to me, guys," Midas said.
"We're good," Chavez came back. "Our 2 bad guys decided to engage the police. Are you guys all right?"
"We're good," Midas said. "Chen and Kim Su are down."
"Dead?" Chavez asked.
Jack put a hand to Chen's neck.
"Chen's still alive," he said.
Yuki did the same with Kim Su, but shook her head.
"Get them off the street if you can," Chavez said. "If you can manage to stop shooting, the cops might think these other dudes are responsible, at least until ballistics comes back. These idiots appear to be ready to go down in a hail of bullets, so they won't be around to question either. I figure you got about 5 minutes while the cops still have their hands busy."
Yuki picked the lock to the back door of a bar off the alley, leading into a storage room stacked high with boxes of wine and assorted liquor. Midas dragged in Kim Su's body as well, in case any local police came up the alley from the other end to investigate. Ryan and Yuki leaned Chen against a stack of Suntory whiskey boxes and brought him around with a pinch to the underside of his upper arm. Shamisen music came from the thin door to the main bar, along with a sliver of green neon. Otherwise, the storage room was dark.
"Jackson," Yuki said, "you must give me the revolver."
Ryan shook his head. "Not yet. Still too sketchy out there."
"I will return it if needed," Yuki said. "Possession of a firearm is 7 years in prison in this country, no matter who you are."
Ryan groaned and handed over the revolver, but first, he took his frustration out on a moaning Vincent Chen.
"Tell us something, champ," Ryan said. "What are you doing in Japan?"
Chen put a hand to his shoulder, exploring the wounds, then looking to the floor at Kim Su.
"I think the bitch shot me," he said.
"I think so too," Ryan whispered. The gaping exit wound in front of Chen's chest indicated the shot had come from behind.
"Seriously, though, you some kind of bagman or what? I can get you protection if you help us out."
"Protection would be most welcome," Chen said.
"They will kill—"
He began to cough up a pink foam, choking on his own blood.
"Damn it,"
Ryan hissed. At least one of the rounds had punched through Chen's lung. He put a finger to the man's lips, grateful for the shamisen music.
You gotta hush, dude, or they'll find us.
He had no idea who they were, but Chen was scared of somebody.
Gang...
Chen coughed again.
For... kill...
He attempted another cough, but there was no energy in it. His words trailed off in one last rasping breath. Yuki put her fingers to his neck.
He is gone. Son of a bitch,
Ryan hissed. They trail this guy all the way around the world, and now he dies spewing nothing but gibberish.
Did he say kill?
Couldn't tell, Midas said. He might have. Maybe gang for key or gang for kill. Hell, none of it makes sense.
Gang of four?
Adara guessed over the net. That's got Chinese implications.
Could be, Ryan said.
None of this helped him figure out what threats might be facing his father. How's it looking out there?
One shitbird is down, Chavez said, and the other has to be running out of bullets. You guys haul ass as soon as you're able. We'll sit tight here and play innocent bystander until things simmer down.
Copy that, Ryan said. He grabbed Vincent Chen's leather briefcase, relieved to find a laptop computer inside.
That was something, anyway.
With any luck, Gavin could link to it remotely and give them a little nugget to go on. Yuki took Kim Soo's ID and cell phone. Ryan draped the case over his shoulder and took a quick peek out the back door. The police were still busy at the other end of the path. Rain pummeled the pavement, throwing as much spray back up as came down. If anything, it was raining even harder than before. They couldn't retrace their steps. There would surely be crowds gathered around the wounded, and possibly dead they'd left behind. The police might even be there by now. Better to go straight out the front of this place. The shamisen music stopped abruptly when Yukiko led them into the cramped 6x15-foot bar, shouting like the place was on fire and pointing back at the storage room. Ryan didn't know exactly what she was saying, but he was pretty sure it was something about dead bodies and men with guns. They were out the door before anyone recovered from the shock. Keeping east, they fell in with a fleeing crowd and were shunted through the red torii gates of the Hanazono Shinto shrine by a line of police officers staffing a barricade. You were right, Ryan said as they slogged through the rain, over the gravel courtyard of the shrine. A female brought down Vincent Chen. He looked at Yuki, rain pressing a pale shirt to her shoulders, dripping from her bangs. Long tresses clung to her cheeks. A woman would probably be his downfall as well.
Chapter 59
Protocol dictated that the paramount leader of China should arrive last, just prior to departure. Support staff and Colonel Huang had timed the ride to the airport so they could lift off moments after President Zhou was seated. The plane was a Boeing 747 used by Air China as a passenger jet when it was not pressed into service to fly the Chinese president on international trips. Prior to becoming China's version of Air Force One, the 747, usually one of two, was fitted with more luxurious furnishings, including beds, sofas, and plush seating. Madame Zhou enjoyed flying in such comfort. She had wanted to accompany him to Japan, but present circumstances made that an imprudent idea. Zhou was not surprised to see Foreign Minister Li's motorcade already on the tarmac as his armored Hongqi L5 limousine came to a stop behind the uniformed military escort. He was, however, surprised to find Minister Li speaking with that detestable General Xu of the Central Security Bureau. The sun was up, a dull orange disk through the greasy pall of haze to the east, but lights illuminated the base of the plane and the length of red carpet rolled out from the air stairs. The gaggle of men around Li and Xu snapped to attention when they saw the president approaching. Li gave a slight bow. Xu, a bow that was even slighter.
Good morning, Zhou Juxi, Li said.
He gave Colonel Huang a look of uncharacteristic sympathy.
I was sorry to hear about your men. The criminals responsible will be captured and punished to the fullest extent, I am sure.
Colonel Huang thanked him for his courtesy, but looked nervously up and down the tarmac.
Zhou Juxi, General Xu said, the attack on your protective staff is what finds me here to greet you this morning. I have seen personally to providing 3 replacements from among our very finest at the Central Security Bureau.
Zhou nodded thoughtfully.
I was under the impression that the very finest would be assigned to the paramount leader in the first place.
Just so, Xu blustered. But CSB has many talented and skilled officers. Is that not correct, Colonel Huang?
It is, General, Huang said. Zhou turned to him. Do we need more personnel?
General Xu is correct, he said. We should not travel without a full complement.
Do you know these replacements, Colonel?
Zhou asked.
I do, sir, Huang said, by name and reputation. I have not had the pleasure of working with them.
You know best, of course, General, Zhou said. Is something wrong, Zhou Juxi? Li asked.
No. Zhou shook his head. The timing is unfortunate, that is all.
Please, Li said, allow me to offer 3 of my security detail. They are accustomed to working directly with Colonel Huang and his men. The 3 new officers may assume responsibilities for my protection. General Xu started to object, which made Zhou more prone to accept the offer. He raised an eyebrow. This seems quite outside the norm.
Li bowed again. The timing, as you say, is unfortunate. It would be my great honor to second Colonel Long Yun and 2 others. The best of my best.
I could not, Zhou said.
Your safety is paramount, Li said. Please, do me this honor.
Colonel Huang's jaw muscles flexed. He was obviously surprised at the news.
Very well, Zhou said. He put a foot on the bottom step and then turned to the other 2 men. Have either of you been in contact with Admiral Qian? I wish to speak to him, but his staff said he is incommunicado.
General Xu shrugged. Perhaps inspecting one of our submarines, Mr. President.
Perhaps, Zhou said, and bounded up the stairs.
I must go, Li said, as soon as the paramount leader was out of earshot. What is this business with Admiral Qian? Xu asked. I have not been able to contact him either. That man has disappeared.
I'm sure it is nothing, Li said, turning to climb the stairs. The steward at the top waved him forward with a white glove, telling him, the foreign minister, to hurry.
Li purposely slowed, taking his time up the last few steps, then noted the steward's name as he turned to find his seat.
Li took his spot in premium seating directly aft of the paramount leader's office and quarters. He took his mobile phone from the pocket of his suit jacket before handing it to a steward, not the idiot who had rushed him, and pressed the number for his wife. Oddly, there was no answer, even at this early hour. She'd been awake when he left. He tried his son, still reaching nothing but voicemail. He smiled a tight smile, fending off the inevitable worry of a man with many enemies who was leaving town. The flight was just over 3 hours. He would try again when they landed.
Chapter 60.
If there was one fortunate thing about being tired all the time, President Ryan knew, it was that he could usually nap at any given moment. It hadn't always been that way. The threat board being what it was, urgent and stacked, it had a tendency to keep thinking people up at night. But as he spent more and more time with the sword of Damocles suspended over his head, Ryan's brain and body formed an uneasy truce, allowing thoughts on topics such as nuclear destruction or a fragile economy to simmer in the background instead of boiling over the moment his head hit the pillow. Kathy said he dreamed more now, tossing and turning and mumbling nonsensical things in his sleep. Ryan rarely remembered his dreams, which made him believe there was a God and that he was merciful, because the dreams of a powerful man with any conscience at all were by necessity bad dreams. He woke to the change in pressure in his ears as Air Force One began a gradual descent over Japan. Hopefully, the four-hour nap would get his body clock somewhere in line with Japan time. They would be wheels down at Yokota Air Base at 9:20 a.m. local, giving him a full day of meetings when his brain told him it was 8:20 p.m. in D.C. It was going to be a long one, so he shaved and put on a clean shirt and a midnight blue tie. Kathy said the color made him look serious, which he thought was appropriate, considering his upcoming meeting with President Joe. Though surely terrifying for the crew, the business with R.V. Merriweather had proven a litmus test for the power struggle that appeared to be going on inside China. Either Joe was a liar, or he didn't have control of his military. The former, Ryan had come to hope. The latter would be a nightmare. Special Agent Gary Montgomery sat on the sofa outside the president's office and gazed out the windows at the ocean below. He didn't much care for water. It could kill you, but you couldn't kill it back. POTUS would be up soon, so Montgomery buttoned the top button on his white shirt and straightened his tie. He always brought two ties to work, a red one and a blue one, so he'd not be wearing the same color as his protectee. It was weird. Montgomery admitted that, but it was something he did for luck. Well, that and countless hours at the range and in the gym. The president had been wearing a red power tie when they left Andrews, and Montgomery was happy he'd chosen a blue Brooks Brothers for today. This was his first flight with President Ryan, and he wanted everything to be perfect. His years in the Secret Service had taught him that if something could go wrong, it would. Montgomery didn't relish the idea of having a man he respected as much as Jack Ryan standing over his shoulder when things inevitably turned to shit. The Japanese took a dim view of firearms and strictly enforced who could and could not carry for all but the agents immediately surrounding the president. Even these were warned of Japanese gun laws, but no one stopped the President of the United States or the dozen close protection agents who arrived in the motorcade with him. Montgomery had been told it was a wink and a nod sort of agreement, with the Japanese not doing very much winking. Or nodding. Yeah, Tokyo was touted as the safest city in the world, but the President of the United States had enemies, and it took only one devoted son of a bitch to ruin your whole day. Especially if half your team was standing around holding nothing but air when they should be holding Sig Sauer pistols. Most of the heavy weapon portion of the vehicle package would be staffed by Japanese police, yet the Secret Service still had two armored limos and a number of their own follow-ups and staff vehicles. When they did move on the ground, the motorcade would be a staggering 43 vehicles long, not including the motorcycle escorts that would provide rolling roadblocks prior to every intersection. The helos from HMX-1 were already on the ground as well, with backup air support in the form of two CV-22 Ospreys that had recently been stationed at Yokota. The 15-minute trip on Marine 1 from Yokota Air Base to downtown Tokyo would be a hell of a lot better than a 40-minute drive. Mitzi Snelson, lead advance for the detail, advised that the Palace Hotel, the location of POTUS's bilat with the Chinese president, was buttoned up tight. She would meet them on the roof. Montgomery looked at his watch and then knocked on the office door. "Mr. President," he said, "wheels down in 5 minutes." Ryan's voice came back through the door. "Very well. Everything good to go on the ground?" "We're all set, sir," Montgomery said, though he couldn't help but feel like he was forgetting something. Decades on the job, and this trip had him feeling like a damn rookie. "Good," Ryan said, opening the door. He was wearing a midnight blue tie instead of the red one he'd had on when they left. Montgomery bit his tongue and forced a smile. Ryan saw his change in mood. "Is something wrong?" "Not a thing, Mr. President." "The Akasaka guest house is very secure," Yuki said. She was sitting beside Jack Ryan Jr. on the Marunouchi subway line, heading back toward Tokyo Station and the Palace Hotel. Ryan's chest needed stitches, but Adara had fixed him up with some superglue and a sticky bandage that stopped him from bleeding through his shirt. The team had almost nothing to go on, aside from some cryptic phrases about a gang, and possibly the word kill, which was chilling in and of itself, if that's what Chen had actually been saying. The fact that Chen was in town at all was bad news, and Jack tried to console himself that the man's cadre was dead or in jail. Yuki's superiors had told her the second gunman had survived and was in intensive care. Amanda Salazar and the man Ryan had knocked out were in police custody, refusing to talk. Their respective embassies had been notified, and both would probably be released after all the visiting dignitaries left town, unless Yuki's organization could find a reason to hold them. "Thanks," Ryan said. "I know you have plenty of work, without me here having you run down a bunch of dead ends." Yuki smiled. "We have a saying here in Japan. Nokori mono ni wafuku ga aru. Luck is in the leftovers." "I'm not sure what that means." "It means," Yuki said, "that we must keep going. We find our luck by working through to the last." "I hope my friends have some luck with Chen's computer." "I would be severely reprimanded for letting you tamper with that," she said, "if my superiors were to find out." "I know," Ryan said, "and like I said, I'm sorry to put you in this spot." The train rumbled to a stop at Kusumigaseki. They were two stops from Tokyo Station, and the cars were getting crowded. Three middle-aged women boarded and held the suspended rings in front of Ryan as the train began to move. His dad would not approve of his lack of chivalry. "Japan has a lot of cool proverbs," he said, "but I don't care for the custom of men sitting while women stand. I think I'll offer one of these ladies my seat." Yuki put her hand on his arm and left it there. "Please," she said, "it is more polite for you to sit." "Seriously?" Ryan said. "Because I might offend some other dude that didn't think of it first?" "No." She smiled, leaning in close to share a secret. "You take up too much space." Ryan looked at her. She still hadn't moved her hand off his arm, and he was fine with that. "Too much space?" She squeezed his arm now, flirting a little, maybe. "You are quite bulky compared to most Japanese. I am embarrassed to say that some might think you kabukai yabanjin, a hairy barbarian." She raised her eyebrows. "I do not think so, of course." "Of course." Ryan gave her a slow nod, but he kept his seat until the train stopped at Tokyo Station. Yuki led the way out of the Maru no Uchi Tunnel. They opened their umbrellas against a steady rain and walked almost due west, past a water garden on the right, toward the Imperial Palace moat. Lots of water. Ryan had a lot of personal experience with the Secret Service. He was sure they'd already had scuba divers check the water features and run a couple dozen waterborne attack on the principal drills back on some lake near Biltsville. They passed a small shrine and a white castle across the water, the colors and edges of everything muted by the rain and mist. "This country looks amazing when it's wet," he said. "I think so as well," Yuki said. "You must be careful, Jack. When you try to leave Japan, ushirogami wo hikareru. It will always tug at the hair on the back of your neck." "I can believe that." Chavez's voice came over the net. He was still at the hotel babysitting Chen's computer while Gavin Beery worked to break the passwords and encryption so he could conduct a remote assessment of its contents. Midas and Adara had been going from place to place, looking for any needles in the haystack of G20 venues. They all planned to link up around the hotel, across the street from the Imperial Palace and grounds. "I've been trying to call you, Mono," Chavez said. "Gavin got in." His voice was far from happy. "Okay," Ryan said. "An assassination plot?" "Gav's still going over files," Chavez said, "but not so far. Just as Eddie Fung suspected, Chen is connected to the Beijing subway bombing. He was paid a nice sum for that one. But get this.
Did you read about the soldier getting killed in Chad and an attack on a Navy vessel somewhere over near Bali?
Yeah, Jack said.
Chen received payments around the time of those attacks. And, of course, the bombing in Argentina.
Ryan pondered the ramifications.
Taiwan?
Not even close, Chavez said.
Foreign Minister Lee. Gav got some weird hits checking some back channels. First, he thought the connection was just because Lee was a victim in the Argentina thing. But Lee and a PRC general named Xu own shares in a diamond mine in West Africa. Get this. Vincent Chen's sister Lily is a minority partner in the same mine.
Ryan stopped in his tracks.
So Chen and Foreign Minister Lee are connected? Maybe the sister hired Chen to kill her business partner.
Yuki turned around to listen to Jack's half of the conversation.
We have to pass this up the chain, Jack said. Jerry's getting it to our friends at the crossing now.
He meant Liberty Crossing, home of the office of the Director of National Intelligence, Mary Pat Foley. She would know if there was anything in the works regarding Lee.
I'll get back to you, Chavez said. Jerry's calling.
Ryan filled Yuki in as they crossed Uchibori Street, which was blocked off to vehicular traffic for the entire block in front of the hotel. They were able to walk north along the Imperial Garden Moat. Yuki stopped with the gathered crowd directly across the street from the hotel. A dozen uniformed police officers and security guards in white hard hats formed a polite but unyielding skirmish line along the sidewalk, allowing people to look as long as they were empty-handed. Photography, or even holding a phone, was strictly prohibited. Three helicopters thumped in the gray sky overhead, two peeling off while the third hovered over the hotel roof, settling in for a landing. Marine One. Jack felt his gut twist, knowing that his father was stepping into some serious unknowns.
You needn't worry about the president, Yukiko said. The Wadakura fountains and ponds form a natural barrier to the south of this venue, and the police have closed the roads around the entire block. She nodded toward a large white tent at the end of the street. Any delivery or staff support vehicle, even those of the police, must be screened with mirrors and explosive detection canines. Pedestrians, including security, must show their credentials at that point, and then again inside the building, passing through metal detectors at both locations. It is like the layers of an onion. Concentric rings, countermeasures to thwart bombings, armed assailants, missiles, biological and chemical attacks, and crazy people with samurai swords. You see, it appears that every conceivable attacker has been covered.
Even Kabukai Yabanjin, Jack said.
Especially the hairy barbarians, Yuki said.
Sirens yelped and a motorcade of 15 cars turned off Uchibori and into the security tent half a block down. The black Toyota sedan behind the police lead vehicles bore the red flags of the People's Republic of China.
Joe, Ryan mused.
The motorcade proceeded under the hotel portico, out of the rain. Men in dark suits sprang from the two follow-up sedans, facing outbound as they surrounded the limousine. Some of them would be Japanese SPs, security police, but like the United States, China preferred to bring a relatively large contingent of her own personnel. Ryan took a half step forward in order to get a better look. It was hard to be certain in the rain from so far away.
Do those two guys look familiar?
Yuki moved up beside him.
I think so.
President Zhou exited his limo, purposely shielded from clear view by the vehicle and the pillars in front of the hotel entry. He and several members of his security detail disappeared into the hotel. The motorcade pulled forward and then stopped again. More security men got out and surrounded a second protectee.
Foreign Minister Lee, Yuki said.
I know who those men were.
Me too, Ryan said into the microphone on his neck loop.
Hey guys, we got a problem.
Chapter 61. Jack looked up at the 23-story hotel. His father was somewhere up there right now. He fought the urge to pace back and forth.
Everyone going in has to be credentialed, right?
Correct, Yuki said. We can check the photo database. She took out her cell phone, but a barked command from one of the policemen sent her and Jack to the end of the block. Ryan held her umbrella while she worked.
Are you sure they were Lee's guys? Midas asked over the radio.
Pretty sure, Ryan said. At least two of them were with him at the restaurant bombing in Argentina.
Chavez weighed in. All the Chi-Com bigwigs get protection from the CSB. It's like our Secret Service and Diplomatic Security Service combined.
True, Ryan said. But the change at this point is too big a coincidence. Chen's getting paid to whack people, maybe even by Lee, and then Lee's protective detail moves over to Joe on the same day he's meeting with my dad.
Yuki's right. This place is completely buttoned up from everyone except the close protection agents. It's impossible to guard against the guards.
You're right, Chavez said. We need to alert the Secret Service.
Wait, Ryan said. Let's think this through a second. Yuki might be able to get us upstairs.
She shook her head.
I am not credentialed to go in. I could get approval, but it would take time.
That's a no-go then, Ryan said. But if it is an assassination plot, these guys smell an alarm and they'll just open fire. The Secret Service won't know what's going on. No matter who the target is, everybody in the room will be sitting ducks.
Yuki held up her phone.
You are correct, she said. Three new officers from the Central Security Bureau were credentialed for President Zhou's protective detail, including a man named Long Yun, the former agent in charge of Foreign Minister Li's security team.
Bear with me here, guys.
Jack passed the umbrella to Yuki and began thumb-typing feverishly into his cell phone. He copied the text, then hit send, pasted the text, hit send again, pasted the text once more, then sent it a third time.
Okay, he said, heaving a tense sigh once he'd sent the last text. When I was a kid, my dad missed one of my baseball games because he had to work. It really tore him up. He made this deal with all of us that if he was physically able, it wouldn't matter if he was with the Queen of England herself, he'd answer a call after three hang-ups in quick succession.
He blew out a heavy breath, nerves wound tight.
Trust the guy on the ground, right, Midas?
Roger that, Midas said.
Well, Jack said, Dad's the guy on the ground.
What did you send him? Adara asked.
Three bad guys new to Joe's detail. Violence likely.
He'll know what to do.
I hope.
The two presidents had elected to conduct the short bilateral meeting alone, but for a single security man each. Gary Montgomery had 40 pounds and 5 inches on Joe's man, but the Chinese security agent appeared to vibrate with intensity. Neither were about to let anything, even a slight, happen to their respective charges. The two other members of each protection detail waited in the slightly larger anteroom beyond a set of double doors. Ryan was seated in one of two chairs to the right of the Chinese leader. They were close, less than 3 feet apart, quartering away from a floor-to-ceiling window. A washroom was to Ryan's immediate right in the corner of the small 10-by-10-foot room. Interpreters and other staff would assist them later, but for now, each saw the necessity of sitting down face-to-face and speaking candidly. Advanced staff from both delegations had agreed to a small room off the back of one of the larger ballrooms. Politicians from around the world met in this hotel often, and there were several such private spaces, small enough for quiet conversation, and with a slightly larger private antechamber beyond double doors that could be opened to form a room large enough for interpreters, additional staff, and photographers requisite for such a meeting. Joe had spent a year at Dartmouth and spoke excellent English. Ryan found him to be quiet, with the almost impenetrable facade common to people who must always guard their words. The best way to break through something like that was a direct approach, something Ryan had always preferred to pussyfooting around.
Your assistance with our research vessel was appreciated, Mr. President, Ryan said.
Joe gave a polite smile and started to say something, but Ryan kept talking. I was, however, extremely concerned with Admiral Qian's disregard for your orders. Joe took a deep breath through his nose. There was no easy reply.
Admiral Qian is in custody, Joe said. Surely even the United States has endured rogue commanders from time to time. There is no House of Cards in China. The party is in complete control.
True enough, Ryan said, sensing Joe wanted to say more and giving him time to do so. Silence, he'd learned, was often the least used and most needed ingredient in good statesmanship. Joe folded his hands in his lap.
The container ship Orion...
Ryan's cell phone began to hum in the pocket of his coat. At least he'd remembered to put the damn thing on vibrate. He ignored it, and it stopped. Then it buzzed again a second later, stopped, and buzzed a third time. Ryan closed his eyes. His kids were grown, all of them old enough to know the importance of what he did, the delicate nature of his meetings. Damn it. That was the point. Of course they knew. None of them would use the family code to bypass normal protocols, if it weren't important. Ryan reached into his pocket and held up the offending cell phone.
I apologize, Mr. President, he said, scanning the message.
It was from Jack. Ryan kept his face passive, motioning Montgomery over with a slight flick of his hand. Colonel Huang came off the wall a half step at the movement, but a look from Joe kept him in place. Ryan said, Gary, I'm going to show you something, and you have to promise to hear me out before you do anything. Everyone in the room was surprised to hear the president speak to his security agent so informally.
Mr. President, this is crucial, Ryan said.
Yes, sir, Montgomery said, sounding extremely unconvinced. Ryan read the text, whispering in the event anyone in the anteroom happened to be listening. Both agents immediately put themselves between their protectees and the double doors, pistols in hand, making themselves as large a target as possible.
New additions to your detail? Ryan asked.
Mr. President, Montgomery interrupted, I need you to step into the bathroom. There was no way out but the double doors. Colonel Huang nodded. Such a move would be prudent, Zhou Zhuxi. The two presidents complied with their experts.
Once they were in the small washroom, Joe said, three new officers were transferred to my team.
Colonel Huang said something in Chinese, presumably a curse.
Long Yun is outside now.
And the other two new ones? Montgomery asked.
Downstairs, Huang said. But Long Yun is extremely fast and accurate with his sidearm. I do not care for him, but honestly, he would be a very dangerous opponent.
Okay, Ryan said. Members of my intelligence community believe your foreign minister may be in the process of launching a coup against you, or an assassination attempt against me. In either instance, unless you are personally involved, we will both be killed.
I assure you,
Huang interrupted his boss, ready to protect his person and his reputation.
Long Yun is from Foreign Minister Li's protective detail.
I believe you, Ryan said. There is evidence to implicate you in this. Far too much evidence, in fact. Piles of it. Too easy to find. I disagree with you and your government on most things, President Zhou. But I would imagine a stupid man would not rise to your office. You are many things, but inept is not one of them. Joe pushed back his glasses, but said nothing.
Someone, Ryan said, has been attempting to convince me that you are a very bad man.
They want you to invoke your Ryan doctrine, Joe mused, saying the words as if they tasted bad, to punish me personally for actions against your nation.
Precisely, Ryan said.
Montgomery spoke next. In any other circumstance of threat to the principal, protocol would be to sound off, cover, and evacuate immediately. So far, he'd done none of the above.
Mr. President,
Ryan raised his hand, cutting him off. We're good for a moment, Gary. The attack won't happen until we walk outside. Here's what I propose.
Colonel Huang was seething by the time President Ryan finished explaining his plan.
He could not leave the Paramount leader in the care of the Americans. That was insane.
I'd go, the burly Secret Service agent said, but your guy would sense a trap and start shooting as soon as I went through the door by myself.
Perhaps we could summon the agent I do trust, Joe offered, isolating Long Yun among your Secret Service agents.
There is no lock on those double doors, Ryan pointed out. If Long smells a rat...
Montgomery was already briefing his three agents outside via their earpieces. They were surely having a difficult time controlling their emotions. Huang knew he would have to move quickly. Reinforcements would flood the room at any moment, and more than a few innocents would die in the ensuing gun battle. The two Secret Service agents, one woman and one man, regarded Colonel Huang warily as he slipped through the double doors and nodded to Major Tsai, the only agent he trusted completely, asking for a break. Colonel Long stepped forward to volunteer, but the female American agent casually body-blocked him. Ryan's plan had been for Huang to arrest Long Yun, but Huang had seen the other man shoot. Reaction being slower than action, Colonel Huang Ju decided on his own plan, one that would ensure the survival of the Paramount leader. Smiling, he swept the hem of his jacket and drew the Taurus. His finger found the trigger as he rocked the muzzle toward Long Yun, firing two rounds from less than 4 feet away. Long took a half step back, going for his own pistol. He wore a ballistic vest, but the 9mm rounds stunned him enough to stagger him, slowing him down for the fraction of a second it took for Huan to rock the Taurus upward and fire two more rounds on the heels of the first volley, catching Long in the throat and above his right eye. Colonel Huang dropped his pistol immediately, raising his hands high above his head to show he was no threat to the armed Japanese officers that poured through the door at the sound of gunfire. Three Secret Service agents, including Gary Montgomery, formed a protective phalanx around Ryan and hustled him through the anteroom and past Long Yun's body to meet another half dozen of their cohort and escort him straight to the roof and awaiting Marine One. The president had wanted to wait and see to Joe, or even scoop him up in the protective bubble. But at some point, those decisions stopped being up to the president. He would understand that. Probably. Maybe. Ryan sent a text to Jack Jr. as soon as they were airborne, letting him know he was safe. He'd call later, catching up as much as he could. He wondered if he'd ever know exactly how Jack had figured out about Joe's detail, and what had led him to look into it in the first place. Some things, Ryan decided, were probably best left unsaid. For the time being, at least. He called Kathy, in case she happened to be watching the news. She wasn't, but it was good to talk to her anyway. Arnie and Mary Pat met him at the Akasaka State Guesthouse, and they drafted a press release that named an unidentified gunman and extolled the fast work of Japanese authorities. If Joe decided he wanted his name involved, that was up to him. So, Mary Pat said, it sounds like Foreign Minister Lee had some sort of relationship with a provocateur named Vincent Chen. He, along with three others in the party, were involved in a coup to oust Joe and have Lee installed as the new president. I'm surprised Joe would let it get this far, Van Damme said. He's steady, but from the outside looking in, he seems to rule with an iron hand. Ryan rubbed a hand across his face, feeling the effects of jet lag and the ebb of adrenaline. While we were lying on the floor, waiting for them to take care of Long Yun, he confided that he had suspected the foreign minister for some time. He considered the plot was intended to get me to invoke the Ryan Doctrine, but he admits he didn't believe Lee would attempt to have him killed directly. Just how was it supposed to work? Mary Pat asked. Ryan shrugged, holding out his hand, watching it tremble slightly. Long Yun shoots Joe and Colonel Huang and my security detail, and me. The guy was apparently an impressive shooter. 5 or 6 headshots. It would have been over in a heartbeat, especially if no one was suspecting it. He'd just blame the assassination on us. Still, Arnie said. I find it odd that a man who's risen to Joe's level could be duped like that. Ryan said, I wouldn't move Joe out of the sneaky bastard category just yet. He admitted to me that he did not expect the attack to happen so quickly after arrival in Japan. He intended to meet with Lee later in the day and let him know his wife and son had been in protective custody since early this morning. I'm sure the foreign minister and his cronies will all be granted fair trials and speedy executions, Arnie said. Mary Pat gave a smug nod. Sounds legit. Ryan turned to Montgomery, who stood against the wall, unwilling to let the president out of his sight. So, Gary, Ryan said, you told Colonel Huang you would have gone to handle it yourself if that were possible? Backing your play, sir, Montgomery said. So you wouldn't have, Ryan mused. Left me with the Chinese, I mean, while you took care of it. No, Mr. President, Montgomery said. Not in a million years. Chapter 62 Magdalena Rojas insisted on going to the hospital to see Eddie Fung and thank him for his kindness that night at Parrott's party. Callahan could hardly say no to the request, considering all the poor kid had been through. She and Caruso stood with her beside Fung's bed. The whites of his eyes were still red with pronounced petechiae from the attempted dead leg hanging, but his ridiculous faux hawk was combed down and he wasn't quite so twitchy, since he'd been off energy drinks for the better part of a week. I'm sorry I stole your thumb drive, the child said. Fung scoffed. I'm not, he said. Not if it got you out. Magdalena leaned over and gave him a hug. He squirmed and looked up at Callahan and Caruso, not knowing what to do. I want to thank that other man, too, Magdalena said. Is he still in the hospital? Callahan shot a narrow look at Caruso. He should be, she said, but someone checked him out. He saved me, you know, she said, and I heard he saved Joe, too. She was one of Parrott's girls, and Paola and Leticia at Matarife's place. She shivered at the mention of the name. He saved us all. I would like him to know we are grateful. What is his name? His name is John. Caruso smiled. I'm sure he knows. A guardian from Child Protective Services put her arm around Magdalena and led her into the hall. What happens to her now? Eddie Fung asked, genuinely concerned. Callahan sighed. I'm not going to lie to you. Lots of counseling, rehab for any drug habits, treatment for STDs, and foster care. As long as you don't send her back to her mom, Fung said, from what she told me, that lady is evil. Oh, no, Callahan said. I'm already working on a way to pinch that awful woman for international human trafficking. She removed the leg irons that kept him chained to the bed. Get some rest, Eddie. You're a weirdo, but you're apparently not a pedophile. Fung threw his head back against the pillow and began to cry. That's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me. Callahan spun on Caruso once they were outside the room. I'm guessing you're going to disappear now as well. He sighed. Yep, into the sunset. Seriously, Dom, I'm not a heartless bitch. I know your friend saved those kids, but that kind of stuff is... It's just old school. That it is, Caruso said. Someone just came in with a writ of habeas corpus and waltzed him out of here, she said. Did you know his fingerprints don't come back to anyone? Caruso shrugged. Come on, Dom. Tell me who he is. It would be nice to know what he's all about. Oh, Kelsey, Caruso said. Some things are nice to know, and some things are just nuts to know. Yuki's credentials had enough juice to get her and Ryan past security and into the business jet departure lounge. The others had already cleared Japanese immigration and gotten the exit stamps on their passports. Reed and the other pilots were already waiting aboard the Gulfstream. Chavez stood at the door leading out to the tarmac with a duffel in his hand.
Sure you don't want to fly back with us? Ding prodded. It's more comfortable than commercial, even business class.
I'm good, Ryan said. Yuki stood right beside him. She wasn't holding his hand, but she may as well have been.
You know I've been wanting to work on a second language.
Think I'll start with Japanese.
I am glad you stayed, Jackson, Yuki said as they walked out to her car. They'd considered taking the train, but Yuki had decided she wanted to take him for a drive into the mountains. It was still raining, and they shared an umbrella, which, Jack realized, was even better than holding hands.
Me too, Ryan said.
Can I ask you something?
They stopped, and she turned to face him under the umbrella. She was half a head shorter than him, and looked up, blinking dark lashes. Mist from the rain dampened her face, despite the umbrella. He considered asking about the scratches on her cheek, but decided this wasn't the time.
Too heavy.
She continued to peer up at him.
Yes?
When did you know that my dad was the President of the United States?
When I saw you in the sewers, she said.
I'm serious.
So am I, Yuki said.
I am, after all, an intelligence officer.
I have a trained eye.
And you didn't say anything about it?
She stood and looked at him for a long moment, and then, seeming to come to a serious conclusion, said,
We have a saying here in Japan.
Oh, really? Ryan said.
And what's that?
She was on tiptoe now, her lips just inches from his, her voice hoarse and breathy.
Sometimes, she said, it is better to shut the hell up.
This is Scott Brick. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Tom Clancy, Power and Empire, by Mark Cameron. This program was directed by Chris Kosheski, executive producer Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2017 by the estate of Thomas L. Clancy, Jr., Rubicon Incorporated, Jack Ryan Enterprises Limited, and Jack Ryan Limited Partnership. Production copyright 2017, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.